From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, political satirist Bill Maher. After his show, Politically Incorrect, was canceled last summer, he started a new book inspired by government-issued World War II posters, which urged Americans to make sacrifices for the war effort. He's reworked those posters with messages about today's war on terrorism. Those posters illustrate his larger critique of how the war is being handled on the home front. The book is called When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Bin Laden. Also, rock historian Ed Ward reviews the newly reissued early recordings of the Rolling Stones in the second part of a series on the Stones' 40th anniversary. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush called on Congress today to complete action this year on a bill to create a new Department of Homeland Security. He spoke to reporters for the first time since Tuesday's election put Republicans in control of Congress. NPR's Pam Fessler has more.
The president said he hopes to see Congress move more quickly on his legislative agenda. He said he expects lawmakers to approve legislation providing terrorism insurance for businesses and to deal with prescription drug benefits for seniors. The president acknowledged that Congress is unlikely to take up many items he supports until next year, but he said there's one thing that's a priority for the lame duck session that begins next week.
The single most important item of unfinished business on Capitol Hill is to create a unified Department of Homeland Security that will vastly improve our ability to protect our coasts and our borders and our communities.
Creation of the new department has been held up by partisan differences over labor management issues. There's no guarantee that a lame duck Congress can finish work on the bill this year. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Police in Atlanta say ballistics tests have linked another murder to a handgun alleged to have been used by the suspects in the Washington area sniper murders. Police say the gun was used to kill a 41-year-old immigrant from Ethiopia outside an Atlanta liquor store. That murder took place just a few hours before one woman was shot to death and another was wounded in an attempted robbery outside a liquor store in Montgomery, Alabama, about 150 miles away. Police have blamed that attack on the sniper suspects, John Allen Muhammad and John Lee Malvo. Earlier today, Attorney General John Ashcroft announced that the suspects will be tried first in Virginia, in part because the death penalty is available if they're convicted. In Texas, a death penalty case is raising questions about whether to execute the mentally ill. James Colburn, a paranoid schizophrenic, was set to die by lethal injection last night, but the U.S. Supreme Court issued a last-minute reprieve. Janet Heimlich has more from Austin.
The reprieve allows James Colburn's lawyers to submit a document asking the High Court to review the case. After that, the court will decide whether to take it up. The decision comes just days after the court rejected another appeal. Colburn was convicted of brutally killing a woman after trying to rape her in 1994. Prosecutors maintain Colburn was competent to stand trial because he was on medication for his condition when he committed the crimes. But Colburn's lawyers say he was so sedated during the trial he could not stay awake. The Supreme Court has decided that it's unconstitutional to execute the mentally retarded, but it has not decided this point for the mentally ill. For NPR News, I'm Janet Heimlich in Austin.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 184 points to close at 85.86. The Nasdaq lost 42 points. This is NPR News. Four former members of a 1970s radical group pleaded guilty to second-degree murder today. They were accused of killing a female customer during a 1975 bank robbery in Sacramento, California. Emily Montague, her ex-husband Bill Harris, Michael Borton, and Sarah Jane Olson robbed the bank to finance the Symbionese Liberation Army, the guerrilla group that also kidnapped newspaper heiress Patty Hearst. They pleaded guilty as part of an agreement that's expected to get them sentences of 6 to 8 years in prison. Olson is already serving time for a 1975 attempt to bomb police cars in Los Angeles. A UN plan for a global ban on human cloning has been put on hold. The United States opposed the ban because it would only apply to reproductive cloning. NPR's Joe Palca reports.
When people talk about human cloning, they can mean two different things. Some people mean using cloning technology to create a baby. that's reproductive cloning, while others mean using it to create stem cells that could be used for research on new therapies. France and Germany led the effort to create a treaty banning reproductive cloning only. The Bush administration has taken the position that no form of human cloning is morally acceptable and has opposed any policy that doesn't include a comprehensive ban. After 30 countries sided with the U.S. position, the U.N. committee considering the ban put off discussion of any cloning proposal for a year. Legislation to ban cloning has stalled in the U.S. Congress for reasons similar to what's happened in the United Nations. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices were down today. The S&P 500 lost 21 points, or 2.2%, to close at 902. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bill Maher's late-night program Politically Incorrect was canceled over the summer, but he is still politically incorrect, saying very intentionally provocative and funny things about the state of our country. He said, "I criticize my country because that's what a patriot does." Maher has a new book in which he offers his critique of America's war on terrorism. The book was inspired by posters issued by the government during World War I and World War II, with messages that encouraged Americans to make sacrifices for the war effort. Maher has reworked those posters with new messages about the war on terrorism. Those posters are the illustrations in his book. The book is called When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Bin Laden, What the Government Should Be Telling Us to Help Fight the War on Terrorism. Bill Maher, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Nice to be back. Thank you, Terry.
Let me ask you to describe the title poster in your book.
Okay. That's true. A lot of people want to know, what does that mean, when you ride alone, you ride with Bin Laden? Well, there was a World War II poster, When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Hitler. And we really just redid that original one. The poster depicted a guy sitting in a convertible with a kind of a ghost outline of Adolf Hitler next to him. And at the bottom it said, join a carpooling club, because they were trying to tell people that by saving oil, you were helping in the war effort. And this is one of the posters that inspired me to do this book, because I was looking through this book of World War II posters, and I was struck not only by how beautiful the artwork is, but also the spirit involved, the way the government was so unafraid in that era to ask the citizens to do something, to pitch in whatever way they could. Whether it was planting a victory garden or saving tin or buying war bonds, more productive at work, you name it. And certainly oil was a big part of that war effort. And, you know, there's no doubt that it's a big part of our war effort, although the government we have would never tell you. So I thought, if they're not going to tell you, then I will. So that's how the cover came about.
This leads to another poster in your book that's called The Empty Podium. Would you describe that one?
Yeah, that one depicts, on the one side, it has 1961 and a picture of Kennedy at the podium, and it quotes his quote, his famous quote about getting to the moon, where he says, "I believe this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before the decade is out of landing a man on the moon." And on the, under that it says, "We did." And then next to that there's an empty podium, and it says, "Today" on the top, and there's a quote, although it doesn't really exist because nobody ever said it, but it's the one I'd like to see. And it says, "I believe this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before the decade is out of being completely independent of foreign oil." And underneath that it says, "We could." And the point is that Kennedy set a goal of 10 years to get to the moon. And if we set a goal of 10 years to be completely independent of foreign oil, of course we could achieve that goal. But it's not a goal that's in the cards, because the government we have is, of course, funded largely in their campaigns, which is what they care about, by money from oil corporations. I mean, we do have two oil men in the White House. So the idea that they're going to turn their back on their contributors is very slim. That to me is, I think, what their idea of integrity is to make sure that they don't betray the people who gave them money to run for the office.
Now, there's a poster in your book at airport security, And, like, you know, like a grandmother is passing through security with her grandson. She's getting frisked. The kid has to take his sneakers off, and they're getting examined. Meanwhile, Bin Laden is just kind of breezing through the radar.
He's going right through the metal detector while grandma gets frisked,
And below it says, political correctness is dangerous. Demand real security. What are some of your beefs about how political correctness is affecting airport security?
Well, I think the picture says it all. The fact that we basically not only search and are suspicious of people randomly, but we brag about it. Secretary Mineta, I quote him in the book, I think it's in that chapter, he was asked on 60 Minutes whether a 70-year-old woman from Vero Beach, I think it was, would receive the same level of scrutiny as a Muslim young man from Jersey City. And he said, I would hope so. And I think the first casualty of war is sometimes common sense. He said passengers should find all the evidence of equal inspection reassuring. And I find it anything but reassuring. I find it a mindless, exploitable system. And that's not what we need. We need focus now. We need heads up right now. And it's funny that when I do my stand-up performance, which is similar to the material in the book, so we project these posters behind me when I'm talking about the subject that is appropriate for the poster. And when I bring up the subject of profiling, I hear, you know, people sort of get uncomfortable with that word, and they don't sound like they're really for it. But when they see the poster, they applaud, which is a tremendous contradiction because the poster is saying, well, we need to do some profiling. And by the way, if they just stopped calling it profiling, if they called it, proactive intelligence screening or high alert detecting, people would say, of course, it's about time. That's what the Israelis do. That is, of course, what all police work is based on. And this is not an attempt to be prejudiced against Muslim people or Middle Eastern people in any way, but it's realistic.
Where would you, Bill Maher, draw the line between what you would consider to be justifiable profiling at airport security and racism?
Well, they're two completely different things. Someone has to willfully not want to understand that they are two completely different things. Just because the word has been applied to both doesn't mean both are the same. And when I say both, I mean pulling over a young black man in a Mercedes driving through a nice neighborhood, that's the bad kind of profiling. That's unjustified because black people driving Mercedes, that has no history or basis. They're not stealing those cars. That's racism. But please, on September 11th, we were attacked by 19 Muslim young men who were on a suicide mission, and their ilk is out there still. In sleeper cells in this country, as we have found out, certainly there is a large pool of recruitment for such a movement in many of the Muslim countries around the world. After September 11th, the most popular name for a baby in Pakistan was Osama. So, when people say it's just a few extremists, well, it's not just a few extremists, and they are drawing from a large pool of popularity in the Muslim world for this cause. So this is a very different situation than domestic, what I would call domestic profiling.
I will say probably a lot of people are thinking it's easy for you to say that because you don't look like you're from the Gulf or the Middle East. You could breeze through if there isn't profiling.
Well,
a lot
first of
people,
all, I never breeze through.
Really? Have you gotten stopped a lot?
All the time, and
are you stopped by guards who recognize you, who know who you are?
Yes, this is something I talked about this on my show before it went off. That maybe it's going to get better now that it's been federalized, and people seem to think it's getting better. I think there's actually an element of racism in that opinion because I noticed that the federal workers are whiter than in general than the workers have been in the past who do that job at the airports. And I think people's prejudice shows through and they go, oh, I think it's better at the airport. I don't see that it's a lot better. I just see that it's a lot whiter. Anyway, yeah, it seems like everyone I know who is in the public eye has gotten stopped an inordinate amount of times because it's just too much fun to go through Kevin Bacon's shaving kit. And I told the story one night on the air about Ray Charles got very angry. And I don't blame Ray Charles for getting angry because he was pulled out of line. And, you know, if you're over 70 years old and you're blind and you're very famous and you're Ray Charles, I don't think that's the guy. Al Gore was pulled out of line. I mean, this is mindless. This is just silly. This is not going to help the situation. There is a finite amount of time and of manpower. And if we pretend that we can randomly suspect everyone equally, we're going to be in big trouble. Like I said, the Israelis don't do this. Their airport, which is the most probably attacked airport in the world, if the bad guys could get at it, is actually the safest. And that's because they can't afford this kind of political correctness that we have. They can't afford to worry about hurting someone's feelings. And we are in basically the same state that they are in now, and we are going to have to get real also. By the way, this profiling is what our attorney general is doing every single day.
You mean, but not at the airports?
Not at the airports, but you know, I mentioned in the book the story of the Arab American Secret Service agent who about a year ago or so he had a gun, and he certainly was a Secret Service agent, but he was an Arab with a gun, and they asked him to step out of line to answer a few questions. You know, it's not like we're putting them in internment camps here. And he was very upset about this. You know, apparently he'll take a bullet for his country, but but a few questions at the airport is too much to ask. And this got all the way up to President Bush, and President Bush said he would be plenty hot if he found out that the man was pulled out of line because he was Middle Eastern. And I just thought that was Dick Cheney's cue to whisper into his ear, "Sir, that is what Ashcroft is doing every day."
My guest is Bill Maher. His new book is called When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Bin Laden. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Bill Maher is my guest. He has a new book called When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Bin Laden, What the Government Should Be Telling Us to Help Fight the War on Terrorism. Are you fazed by the terrorism alerts every time we get to a more heightened color? Do you change your behavior? Do you worry?
I stopped because they never tell us what to do. It's like, you know, code burnt orange, bring a sweater. get in the panic room. There's never any follow-up to that. It's just we're on higher alert today. I guess that means that we could keep our eyes and ears peeled a little more. But, you know, I think a lot of that is just covering their behind because that way when something happens, they can just say, well, we told you so. And that's not really going to get the job done.
A lot of people turned to religion after September 11th for comfort or for just some sense of larger comprehension or sense of their place in the world or whatever. And I'm wondering how September 11th affected your sense of religion.
Well, you know, Terry, we've talked about this before. I am not the fan of religion that I'm sure that the religious people would like to hear on the air. And a lot of times I said things on my show that riled their feathers and got them to be my archenemy. When I was under attack last September, a lot of it came from the Christian right, really, they were behind it because they hate what I have to say about religion. But I'm sorry, I find it to be dangerous, prejudicial, childish, and now I think we need to realize that it, on top of all that, could get you killed. Because as long as we have this clash of civilization that is based on religion, I think we are going to be living in a very, very dangerous world. You know, hatred springs from people feeling slighted, from indignity, from poverty. I think those are the real root causes. I know the hijackers weren't all impoverished, and that's certainly true. But it comes from very deep-seated human resentments and emotions. But it's the religion that justifies it. It's the religion that gives it a framework. It's the religion that allows them to say, I'm doing this for a great cause, and I'm going to get 72 virgins, or whatever it is, and go ahead with it. And that's what's really dangerous, is that religion provides the veneer and the vehicle for them to carry out nefarious plans under the guise of doing something in their mind that's actually quite wonderful.
I wonder if you think that our own politicians cross the line between religion and politics. And for example, I'm wondering if you saw this and what your opinion of it was. Jeb Bush, in his victory speech,
right,
started off by thanking God for,
yes,
for the victory.
I wanted to say, you're not at the Grammys.
God's very busy with the Grammys.
Yeah, you know, it's bad enough when we hear it from rappers, you know, with an enormous platinum crucifix with diamonds encrusted on it hanging from their neck, as if that's the way Jesus would really want to be remembered. That's why he went on the cross, so that they could make a huge platinum encrusted replica of it someday. No, I think it's terrible. But, you know, they all do it. Al Gore did it. Said he asked himself, what would Jesus do, I think. President Bush, at one point early in his campaigning, before he had gotten the script down, said that he didn't think, I'm paraphrasing, I'm not quoting exactly, but the basis of it was that he didn't think that non-Christians could get into heaven. Because, once again, that is the problem with religion, is it's really only a one-lane highway there that's open to heaven. And they think they have the answer, and we think we have the answer. When I say we, I mean Christians in the West. And there's not a lot of wiggle room there. The Bible says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no man cometh into the Father but by me. And in the Islamic religion, they say, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. It's pretty much pick a side. I think that's dangerous stuff, and it's really dangerous when it infects our politics, and no matter what they say, that is exactly what the Founding Fathers were trying to avoid, was that kind of mixing of religion and politics.
Has anyone in your family ever been religious, and what kind of religion were you brought up with?
Absolutely. Well, I was brought up Catholic. I come from a mixed marriage. My parents got married in 1951, when a Catholic, my father, marrying a Jew, my mother, was considered quite outrageous. It certainly was in both of their families, not well received. That was just something people didn't do in 1951. My mother even told me once that she was engaged to someone before my father, who one day took her aside and just said, you know what, this has got to end, because, let's face it, you're a Jew. So I didn't really understand that my mother was Jewish when I was a little kid. We used to just go to church, my father, my sister, I, and myself, and my mother would stay home. And I was just so scared by the church-going experience that I never even asked why. But I certainly was brought up with religion. I went to catechism, and I made my first communion, and I did all of it, and I found it pretty frightening.
What I mean, did it ever mean anything to you, and what frightened you about it?
Well, I was so young, of course it meant the world to me. When I was 5 and 6 years old, it's what they tell you when you're a little kid, and they frighten you that if you don't believe it, you're going to burn in hell, and you know, it was all about fear. I remember just being shaking with fear when I had to go to that First Communion practice. It was a special after-school thing for a while that we had to go to because we were practicing for the First Communion, and I just remember being paralyzed with fear because the nuns were mean, and they were... I remember once I was slumping over in the pew, and the nun said, "The boy who's slumping over is going to go to hell." And...
a confidence builder.
Yeah. And, you know, I was like, gee, if you can get that punishment for slumping over, I don't want to think about what's going to happen when I reach puberty.
In the Jewish religion, if you're born to a Jewish mother, you're kind of automatically Jewish unless
yes.
unless you officially head in another direction. So have you ever felt the kind of Jewish side of your family?
Absolutely, because the relatives that I knew growing up were all the relatives on my mother's side. My father's family lived further away.
Mm-hmm.
But the relatives on my mother's side were all in the New Jersey area, so every year we'd have a Christmas party on Christmas, and it was all the Jewish people who came over. they weren't terribly... my mother's family was not terribly religious. They were Jewish. They knew it. They were happy about it, but they didn't go to temple or any of that. But, I mean, in general, the Jewish religion is a lot cooler, I would say, than the Christian religion. The Christianity is a lot more about fear and what's going to happen to you if you don't behave and repercussions and silly rules. You know, the Christianity started out fantastic. I mean, Jesus Christ is about the greatest role model anyone could ever ask for. But boy, did it get hijacked along the way.
Bill Maher, his new book is called When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Bin Laden. He's starting a performance tour that includes stops in Washington, D.C., New York, Boston, and Chicago. Bill Maher will be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by this and other NPR member stations. From Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, providing nearly 3 million members with customer-focused financial strategies and service. Online at thrivent.com. And Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of I, Richard by Elizabeth George, author of A Traitor to Memory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Ed Ward reviews the newly reissued early recordings of the Rolling Stones in part two of his series on the Stones' 40th anniversary. Also, more politically incorrect satire from Bill Maher. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with political satirist Bill Maher. His ABC program, Politically Incorrect, was canceled over the summer. Now he has a new book called When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Bin Laden, What the Government Should Be Telling Us to Help Fight the War on Terrorism. Maher is starting a performance tour tomorrow. Let's talk a little bit about the election. Why do you think the Democrats did so badly?
The Democrats deserved to do so badly, because they do not present any sort of choice. They are not the loyal opposition. They are a lapdog to the Republican Party. They don't stand up for what they believe in, and they got what they deserve. They got their head handed to them, and I'm glad. I don't blame anyone for voting for a Republican. If your choice is between a real Republican and a fake Republican, that is a Democrat who pretty much goes along with the Republican line and doesn't give you the alternative, then why not vote for the real thing?
What do you think it's going to mean to have, like, what do you think is in the near future now that there's a Republican White House, Senate, and House?
I don't think anything will change. We sort of have that already. I used to laugh when I heard Bush call himself a compassionate conservative because I thought, oh, that is a Democrat. I don't think that our Congress is going to behave terribly differently than it has in the past. They pretty much gave him everything he wanted anyway. They voted for the tax cut, which is a terrible direction to take the country in, both economically and especially now that we're at war. They started to mount a little bit of opposition against Iraq, but then people like Senator Kerry caved right in and went along. So I don't think it makes any difference. I think the only good thing to come out of this is that sometime, somewhere along the way, I hope they will start to find their soul again. Stop running away from who they are. Stop running away from Bill Clinton. Erskine Bowles lost in North Carolina, did the same thing Al Gore did in the year 2000, would not let Clinton campaign for him. And when are the Democrats going to learn? Clinton is probably the best asset they have. He's the big dog. Let him in the race. A lot of people still love him. Forget about the people who don't like him. Those people will never like him. And they're not going to vote for Erskine Bowles anyway.
The Democratic Party was very cold, I should say, to Al Gore after the presidential defeat. And I wonder if you think Gore looks good by comparison to what the results were this time around. Like, look in Florida, the big margin that Jeb Bush had. You know, Gore did much better than the Democratic gubernatorial candidate in Florida.
You're right. That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that, but I always love election night in Florida, or as they call it, mischief night.
You spent a lot of time on your show talking about Catherine Harris. What do you think of her election?
Well, it was a very safe Republican seat, so I'm not surprised. And And she's a hero to her party because she was obviously very instrumental in the outcome of that election. I've never been one for replaying the 2000 election or Florida. I couldn't bring myself to vote for Al Gore because he is part and parcel to what I was talking about, a Democrat who doesn't really act like a Democrat, doesn't really give an alternative version of what I would like to see out there on many issues, for example, the drug war. He's just as right-wing and hypocritical as the Republican candidate. There was a number of issues that Bush and Gore in the year 2000 didn't talk about because it was a conspiracy of silence. So I'm no big fan of Mr. Gore, and I'm no big fan of going over the 2000 election. If Al Gore, as a sitting vice president, with the kind of economy and prosperity and peace that he had for 8 years to run on, couldn't win that election by more than, well, he actually did win it, but he couldn't eke out a more decisive victory, then he didn't deserve it. He was running against an opponent who was not formidable. He's formidable now. Now he's going to be legendary because people are going to feel like he's the one president who was able to win a midterm election. but he certainly wasn't in the year 2000. Al Gore lost that election all by himself.
Well, you might say he had your help in the sense that you kind of campaigned on your show for Ralph Nader, which took, I think, a number of votes from that people might otherwise have placed with Al Gore and the Democratic Party. And I wonder if you have any regrets about that in retrospect.
Absolutely none. I certainly didn't campaign for Ralph Nader on my show, but I wasn't going to lie if someone asked me, who are you backing? Yes, absolutely. And I certainly don't agree with everything Ralph Nader says. But at least Ralph Nader is a candidate who says what he believes. And politics has become such a cynical marketing manipulation that if we don't start somewhere in getting back to believing in what we are voting for and believing in the people, then I don't know where this is going. I really don't. For people to stand up and cheer when George Bush says, I'm cutting your taxes and it's your money, is a cruel joke, because that money is not going to them. When he says big business will be held to the highest standards of conduct, which he said after the corporate scandals broke, it's also a cruel joke, because it's because of people like him who have fought campaign finance reform that business hasn't been held to the highest standards, because they don't want to insult and alienate the people in those corporations who gave them the money to run ads that fooled people into thinking they were on the people's side. It's perverse the way that the people ultimately pay for their own bamboozlement.
Bill Maher, do you think we should be going to war with Iraq?
No.
Why not?
Well, I've been comparing Iraq to a case of herpes, that's a disease that gets contained, that suddenly became cancer. And I think it became cancer suddenly because an election issue was needed. 3 months ago, the Democrats were going to win this election based on the economy, which is not in good shape. And one of the reasons it's not in good shape is because of that tax cut. But the subject got changed, and that's what real smart politicians do. The Republicans just run much better campaigns than the Democrats, and they were able to change the subject. But I don't think the situation in Iraq has changed in the last 12 years, and the reasons that they gave to be suddenly so alarmed about Iraq, I don't buy. Saddam Hussein is certainly not in league with Osama bin Laden. I don't care how many times they try to sell that. That dog will never hunt. Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden hate each other. Bin Laden hates Hussein the way he hates the royal family in Saudi Arabia. He sees them as corrupt nationalists. And the idea that a megalomaniac, paranoid dictator like Saddam Hussein would give an atom bomb to a religious guy like bin Laden, he would never give an atom bomb to anybody else, most not to Osama bin Laden, because bin Laden would use it on him, perhaps.
So do you think we'll really go to war with Iraq, or do you think the subject will be changed again?
I do think the subject will be changed again. Now that the election has been won, and look, maybe it will do some good. Maybe Hussein will actually be bluffed into relenting. I think that may very well happen. And in that case, President Bush should get a pat on the back if he can bluff this guy into allowing real inspectors in, because he is a threat down the road. But I think it's a much greater threat that we actually drive these two enemies together with our saber rattling. These are two people who did not want to work together and were pretty much forcing them to.
My guest is Bill Maher. He has a new book called When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Bin Laden. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Kumar is my guest. He has a new book called When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Bin Laden, What the Government Should Be Telling Us to Help Fight the War on Terrorism. Bill Maher, what do you miss most about not having your show Politically Incorrect?
You know, I haven't had time to miss it because I went into this book almost immediately after the show ended. But there are days when I pick up the paper and I read something and I so want to get my two cents in on it. So I think that's what I miss. It hasn't happened that much, but sometimes there's an item in the paper. Sometimes it's not a big item. And I just know that there would be a rich subject to tackle, and I can imagine a panel that would be fun chewing it over with me. But in general, you know, it was a good 9-year run, and, you know, when you get to be middle-aged like I am, you realize that, you know, there is a finite amount of time. You can't do everything, and if you do one thing for too long, well, then you don't get a chance to do a lot of other things. So I love that show, but I'm very okay that it came to an end because it's an opportunity to do other stuff.
The show was so much about bringing people together from different points of view.
Yes.
And having them all give their take on the issues of the day. Did you change your mind about anything as a result of speaking every night with people who disagree with you?
Absolutely.
What?
Hunting. I'm still very much an animal rights activist, and I don't know can't imagine why anyone would take pleasure in shooting a beautiful animal. But I did come to understand that sometimes the hunters are more environmentalist than the people who live in the cities and just eat the meat that comes to the supermarket. They very often are doing it because they don't want to eat tainted food. And I'm very much on that page. I think our food supply is completely poisoned with preservatives and hormones and antibiotics and a lot of other stuff that's making us very unhealthy. And I have more respect than I used to for someone who is a hunter in that sense, almost like the Indians used to hunt, you know.
Now, one of the people who was a very frequent guest on your show and was also very, very far to the right was Ann Coulter. And you became good friends.
Yeah.
So what is the basis of the relationship? Because you're so involved with your political point of view.
Right.
What's the basis of a relationship with somebody who has a very opposing point of view to yours?
Well, contrary to popular belief, it's not sex. She's just my friend, and people think it's all based on pillow talk. But I promise you, we're just friends, but we're really good friends. And one thing that doing that show taught me was that you can become friends with people who you absolutely disagree with. And I think people should. One reason I'm able to do that is because, first of all, I'm only 99% certain I'm right about anything. And I think everyone should have that attitude. If you don't, it's arrogant. It's arrogant to think that you absolutely 100% know you're right about anything. So, you know, who knows? I could get up to the pearly gates and find out Ann Coulter had it all right. I doubt it, however. But the other thing is, what I love about Ann Coulter is that she's sort of a version of myself in that she absolutely never pulls a punch. Even when she's saying something that I think is outrageous, it's what she really believes, and she doesn't back off of it. And that is what I find so refreshing and, unfortunately, so unique. I can't name five other people who do that, who don't calculate before they speak. If she believes that nuns should carry guns, then she'll just say that. Or whatever she said about how we should conquer the Muslim countries and convert them to Christianity. It's insane. I don't agree with it. But you know what? I have to give it up to her because she absolutely says what she thinks and doesn't back off of it, is not afraid to get booed. You know how wonderful a quality I find that? Not afraid to get a little booing. People in this country are so lame about that. They're so lame about worrying about their popularity, politicians, people in show business. They're so afraid that that mass out there, that bunch of hamsters who are pushing a pedal of approval, will somehow push the wrong pedal. Oh, I did not like that very much. I liked it somewhat. Well, how about just saying what you feel and whatever they feel? Fine. If they don't agree with you, what's the worst that can happen? Well, I tell you, I know. I experienced what the worst that could happen. You get fired. So what? You go on.
Okay. Now, how did you find out you were getting fired? Did you find out from ABC or did you learn about it from the newspapers?
I think I learned about it from intermediaries. I think I learned about it from my agents and managers. I don't think, I mean, ABC people were always kind of afraid to talk to me, so.
But that's a legitimate way, I mean, to go through channels and learn about it from your managers, but it wasn't.
Oh, sure. What, you know, I was never mad at ABC. ABC is a corporate entity, as it was when I joined it. I had no illusions about it then. I have no illusions about it now. I, quite frankly, I'm surprised we lasted 6 years on ABC. I mean, the idea of mixing the concept of Disney, which owns ABC, and politically incorrect, is like what a silly marriage idea that is.
Did you ever consider entering politics?
No. When I had to make a statement on my show about the show getting canceled, I addressed that question because that week, when the news came out officially that we were going away, a lot of people said to me, "Ah, you could run for office now," which only made me laugh because I am the last person who could ever run successfully for office because the opinions I have are not mainstream opinions. And I read a whole list of them. It was pretty funny, a litany of the things that I've supported or not supported and believed in over the years. You know, like I think religion is bad and drugs are good. This is not the basis to run a political campaign in America. I'm for mad cow disease. I think the Vietnam War was a war we had to fight. You know, I have a lot of opinions that just do not jive with the vast, unreasoning beast, the public, if I may.
Okay, one last question, which I'm sure you won't want to share. Have you lost a lot of money in the stock market this past year?
I've lost money in the stock market. I think everybody has. I think the key for me is never having I never put all my money in the stock market. I think I'm about, you know, 30% or something. So I didn't do too terribly bad. I think I came out pretty even because I guess I have bonds or whatever. I don't know. But when I look at those statements, it's astounding. I'm astounded that it's not more of an issue still. Do you realize that we've lost $8 trillion of wealth in the last 2.5 years? That is going to run into real money someday. And I don't know why people are not more upset about this. I would think that if there's one thing that Americans care about and vote about, it's their money. And like I was saying before, you know, it's campaign donations from cheating corporations that allow laws to get softened and unenforced. And the fact that the president fights for a Harvey Pitt or a William Webster to be the fox to guard the hen house, I don't understand why his popularity is so great.
We only have 1 second left, but do you feel the things that you say as a comic you couldn't ever say if you were actually in politics, that you could only speak your mind politically if you weren't in politics?
Exactly. You said 1 second.
Well, you got it. All right.
But you're exactly right. That's right. That's why I'm going to stay doing what I'm doing, because you can't speak the truth in politics. God forbid you can't speak anything.
Bill Maher, thank you so much.
Terry, it is always a pleasure to be on with you.
Political satirist Bill Maher. His new book is called When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Bin Laden. He's starting a performance tour tomorrow that includes stops in Washington, D.C., New York, Boston, and Chicago. Coming up, the second in Ed Ward's two-part series on the 40th anniversary of the Rolling Stones. This is Fresh Air. The 40th anniversary of the Rolling Stones has seen an avalanche of publicity, as well as yet another world tour. Among the events has been the remastering and re-release of their early albums. Rock historian Ed Ward sat down and listened to all of them, and here's his report.
As part of the 40th anniversary of the birth of the Rolling Stones, we're being treated to a massive reissue of their early catalog by Abco Records, owned by their former business manager, Alan Klein. Not only has every album been reissued in its original form, which means two copies of Out of Our Heads, Aftermath, and Between the Buttons, which had different tracks in their US and UK versions, but each has been remastered, both in normal CD format and a new format, SACD. It's tempting to trot out the old cliches about how you can hear things you've never heard before, but, okay, I'll give in. You can hear things you've never heard before, as well as things that you have, including how out of tune they could be. Everywhere you want, I always go. I always give in because baby, I know. And just say so, because she gives me that feeling inside that I know. The climactic ending of that one is even more excruciating in crisp digital sound, too. But beyond that, it gave me the opportunity to sit down and play the Stones catalog in order, something I never did when I was buying the originals on vinyl, because I was in the middle of living my fandom. Needless to say, 30 years later, the Stones have seen to it that my fandom has diminished considerably through their refusal to change gracefully. The media has played its part, too, with its focus on Mick. Mick? Everybody knows the Stones are all about Charlie. That's from the Charlie Watts solo album, as I've always thought of it, Between the Buttons. For some reason, this album, overflowing with what were then daring new approaches to songwriting, has Charlie way up in the mix. And it's a great chance to hear what his deceptively simple technique brings to the band. Another thing I got to do was sit down with what's widely considered to be the Stones' worst album, their Satanic Majesty's Request. I'm grieved to inform you that the original 3D cover is not reproduced in miniature here, but the record turns out to be much better than I, and probably you, remembered. And when you get to what is undeniably the worst thing the Stones ever recorded, the 5-minute Gomper, one of those tracks that was far more fun to play on than to listen to afterwards, the miracle of digital technology allows you to simply press a button and presto, it's gone. It has to be mentioned that these are exact replicas of the originals. No liner notes, no extra tracks, no personnel listings, no historical context, no added pictures, nothing. Given that extra stuff does exist, this is a shame. But these recordings, the first album from 1964 through Get Your Ya-Ya's Out in 1970, were subject to an intense legal battle between the Stones and Alan Klein, who still owns the rights to them, and perhaps not much more. Still, there's no excuse for omitting liner notes, or perhaps some photos. So which ones should you get? Your favorites, of course. And if you didn't grow up with these records or need a place to start listening to the band, I'd heartily recommend the 3-disc singles collection, which has their singles in chronological order. Each disc of it, too, is over 70 minutes. Who'd have guessed that some of the original albums clocked in at under a half an hour? The one to avoid is Metamorphosis, a bunch of studio scraps overdubbed by anonymous musicians and, some think, issued as a revenge tactic by Klein. And if all this hoopla isn't enough, retired Stones bassist Bill Wyman is back in the bookstores with a $50 coffee table book, Rolling with the Stones, lavishly illustrated from his 40-plus year collection of memorabilia. It's just as myopic as his endless autobiography, A Stone Alone, and just as fixated on finances, but omits the groupie details this time. Nice pictures, though. For my money, the Stones started declining after Brian Jones's death and plunged into total irrelevance in the mid-70s. If there's a remastered copy of Exile on Main Street out there, I should get it, and then I think I'll have all the Rolling Stones I need. Your mileage may vary, but as far as I'm concerned, you can't go wrong with the early Rolling Stones.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Schurach. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Amy Sallet, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Really is too hard to find, so I'm sitting on a fence. The day can come when you get old and sick and tired of life. You just never realize. Maybe the choice you made wasn't really right. But you go out and you don't come back at night, so I'm just sitting on a fence. You can say I got no sense. Trying to make up my mind really is too hard to find. So I'm sitting on a fence.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of I, Richard by Elizabeth George, author of A Traitor to Memory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Joss Whedon. He's the executive producer and writer for Buffy and its spin-off, Angel. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.